Hi, everybody. It's time to get your tickets. The Mormon Expression reception and live broadcast will be on August 6th. Get your tickets now.
Welcome to another edition of Mormon Expression. I'm your guest host, Zilpha, and today I have the privilege of having a conversation with an old friend of mine from high school. His name is Nate, and we both lived in the same little Michigan town. And how old were you when you moved there, Nate?
I was 16. I moved for my junior year in high school.
Okay, so you were in your junior year. Was I going into ninth grade or eighth grade?
I don't know. It seemed like we were always in the same grade, but I guess we were.
I think it was ninth. I think I was going into ninth grade. You were 2 years ahead of me.
Okay.
So you were there for my first year of seminary. So some things about you. You are very handsome, I would say. And you are very intelligent. What was your score on the ACT? That always blew my mind.
I have no idea.
It was either perfect or one off. Anyway, very intelligent, very talented. You play the piano very well, right?
Yeah, that's my whole life is the piano.
And something that probably people have already noticed is that you laugh a lot and that you are kind of in love with life. At least that's how I remember you. You were always just happy and fun. And so that's basically my introduction for Nate. So going back to high school, before we get into kind of the tougher things, I wanted to bring back some memories of some things that we used to do. When we went to seminary, we met at for a while in my dad's chiropractic office, a back room, and you used to play the hymns on this little keyboard, right?
And yeah, that thing was like so awful but so great.
I know, you loved that. And then one time we found an earwig.
Yeah.
And
it was our mascot. We called ourselves the Houghton Earwigs, and we had it trapped under a plastic lid.
Was it under a plastic lid?
Something like that.
Or was it a glass, like, canning jar?
Something like that. But we kept that earwig, and it was our mascot.
For a while. I don't know what happened to it. Let's see. Oh, when you first moved to Houghton, you were absolutely in love with a girl.
That's right. Joanne.
That you met
at a music camp.
Yeah. I mean, and you were, as far as we knew, head over heels for her, and
it was more the idea of her. I mean, looking back, that's you know, what I think it was, is that it was just the idea of her. She was like a really spiritual person, and she was really sweet, and she seemed like the ideal Mormon, and she had a beautiful voice, and so yeah, I was in love with the idea of her, and totally infatuated.
Mm-hmm. And so we all knew you weren't available, even though everyone wished you were. And later you had other girlfriends in high school. One of them had pretty large breasts.
Samantha.
Yeah, Samantha, and she was older than you, and I could never quite figure that one out. The thing that I thought was that you just thought she was pretty, you know, kind of a shallow relationship.
Well, you know what it was. I mean, and now I have like all these years of perspective on it, but what it was with her, I think, is that other guys thought she was hot. And I think you're right. It was because of the big breasts, right?
Yeah.
And she was pretty.
She was very pretty.
And it made me feel like, you know, cool to have a girlfriend that everybody thought was hot.
Mm-hmm. And you would carry around her picture in your wallet and show it off at swim meets and stuff like that.
Yeah, I just, I liked it because it made other guys jealous.
Mm-hmm. We'll come back.
But
we'll
never
come back
did
to
anything. Yeah. I always had the excuse that it was like against my religion. I was really adamant that we didn't do anything sexual.
Uh-huh. Well, I remember later, after you had come out and you told me about one time you were making out with her, and I said, well, you know, didn't you like her breasts? And you said, no, they just got in the way. I wish she didn't have them. I thought that was funny.
Yeah.
So in high school, kids were pretty mean to the Mormons in general. We'll start with that. Do you remember kids picking on Mormons just because they were Mormons?
Yeah, and I think it was also because we were kind of evangelical, too. It wasn't like we just were quietly Mormon. I mean, especially me, I think that I was, like, very vocal about the fact that we were Mormons, so it,
I'm very proud of it, too. So when they would come by and they'd be like, Mormon.
Right.
We were like, so, yeah. But then, yeah. They would say other things that were more hurtful.
Yeah, like that one guy, what was his name? Mike or something?
I remember his name.
Yeah,
yes,
well,
but you're right, that
yesterday.
Is it. Yeah, what did he say to you? I couldn't quite remember that whole.
He just called me a fag. He would call me a fag and, like, kick my feet so I would trip and stuff like that.
It was awful. Didn't you punch him one time?
I think, like, I pushed him against the locker or something.
Yeah.
It was really unlike me.
Yeah. But you just got so mad because he was such a jerk. And he actually used to call me Dyke, too.
He did?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. I didn't know what that was at first, but then I found out. So, they were kind of jerks. But you took it especially hard. And in retrospect, that's understandable because it was something you were struggling with and you didn't.
Exactly. I didn't want to be gay. I knew I was gay. And I was trying so hard not to be gay, and I wasn't, you know, I hated that about myself. And then for somebody to taunt me and call me names and kick me, it was just really hard on me because it was like, he knows, you know,
mm-hmm.
I'm not hiding it, you know.
Mm-hmm. But so, I had no idea. So he was much, much more perceptive than I was. Like, actually,
well, he was calling you a dyke. Maybe he was just like, that's what he did is call people homosexual or something.
Maybe he was.
Yeah.
And that's how he dealt with it. I don't know.
Yeah.
I remember one time in seminary, this is when they first came out with, I don't even know if they still use this program, but the whole new seminary program with all the new videos, that was the first year that I started seminary. And anyway, we used to love those videos, and there was this one that had a guy, and he got his mission call, and he went on his mission. He was riding around on his bike, and he had his tag on, and he was all proud, and the music was called to serve him in the background, and you just cried, and I mean, I'd never seen you do that before, and probably not since. And so afterwards I asked you, you know, what were you crying about? Because, you know, to me it seemed like a happy movie. It wasn't one of those sappy ones. And you said that you really wanted to go on a mission and you weren't, you know, you were afraid you might not be able to.
Right.
I don't know if you remember that.
I don't remember that particular moment, but yeah, I always really wanted to go on a mission and I was always scared that I would fail at it.
Mm-hmm. you did do a lot of proselytizing in high school and had a little bit of you had a little success. Tell us about that.
Well, there was this girl named Wendy, and there was just this big competition between me and the born again Christians as far as trying to win Wendy's soul. But
I never realized that there was a competition.
Yeah, don't you remember, like, what was her name? Caroline? Caroline? Do you remember Caroline?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, she was like, you know, she was like giving Wendy all the anti-Mormon literature at the same time, like, I was bringing her to church and stuff. So, yeah, it was a little bit of a, Wendy was kind of confronted with two different things, and she was trying to choose between them, and then eventually she decided she wanted to join the church. So I baptized her. I don't know. I think it was our senior year, maybe.
It was. Yeah, it was like towards the end of your senior year, it seems like.
Maybe her mom wanted her to wait till she was 18 or something like that.
Yeah, that seems right. And she's since left the church also.
Yeah, she converted to Catholicism. Very odd.
Well, her husband was Catholic, right?
Right, right. I don't talk to her that much, but when I do, she seems like she's content with her life, so that's good.
Let's see. Oh, yes. Well, going along with that, I mean, I never thought that you were just trying to win a competition. The way I saw
it. No. It wasn't that. It wasn't that. It was just that's what it turned out to be. But it was because I love the church, and I sincerely believe she'd be happy if she became a member.
Well, that's what I sensed, because you were always, you were so enthusiastic about the church, and you were so, I wouldn't say in love with Jesus, but man, you loved Jesus and the whole idea of Jesus.
It's funny you say that, because I was just, you know, I knew we were going to talk, and I was just thinking, if there was one thing that I miss about the church, it is that drive that it inspired me to want to be like Jesus. And because I saw that as just unconditional love, learning how to be non-judgmental and love everyone. And now, you know, you've become kind of cynical as you get older and you leave the church. But that's the one thing I miss, is that pure desire I had that they taught me to, you know, love everybody for who they were and not to be judgmental and be willing to do anything for anyone. You know, I miss that.
You were really good at it, too. I'm sure you still are, because I think it's part of your personality.
Well, I mean, my friends will say, oh, I can only tell you this because I know you're the only one that wouldn't judge me for it, you know, that kind of thing. But
yeah.
I don't have that same, you know, my eternal salvation doesn't rest on that anymore. So
right.
I don't have the same, like, intense focus on that. And
the fervor.
Yeah. Maybe, you know, talking about it, maybe I can start thinking about it again a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I feel that way too sometimes. Like, that's the one thing that I'm missing, is that drive to really, you know, to keep trying to be perfect, even though it can drive people insane and in a lot of ways it's not healthy. At least it's, you know, it's something to work for.
Right. Right. It's some spiritual direction.
Yeah, exactly. So, you went off to BYU, and you were majoring in piano performance.
Right.
What was your first year at BYU like?
I had a blast at BYU. You know, friends say, "What was college like at BYU?" Thinking it would be so boring because we couldn't drink or whatever. But we found, I mean, the same as you and me, like, we could have fun jumping in puddles. So we just had a great time. And the irony is that, okay, so we lived in Heritage Halls, which, you know, there's six people in one apartment. So I had like two different sets of roommates, so maybe 10 different roommates, and at least 5 of them have come out of the closet since then.
Really?
Maybe like 7 or something.
Holy
Some absurdly God. Disproportionate number of us ended up friends.
And it was all random. It wasn't like you were friends beforehand.
Well, like the first set was random, but then like, you know, I think the next year we kind of were able to choose or, you know, but still, it was just the, it was the difference in the way we thought. I mean, none of us ever said anything to each other about it at the time, you know, it was all perfectly innocent, but we were just different. You know, and we were just attracted to each other because we were interested in music and we couldn't throw a basketball. And we were artistic and we would decorate our room and just do crazy, crazy, crazy things and laugh and laugh and laugh and laugh. Really
so
fun.
When was the first time that you broached the subject of you being gay to a church authority?
It was President...
So back in high school.
Yeah, it was soon after I moved to Michigan. So, you know, like on the outside, you guys saw this person that had this testimony and was, for, you know, but all that whole time I knew I was gay and I was just, and I don't know if you could ever see that there was, did I completely hide the torture? Did you ever see moments where you saw how tortured I was?
Well, you know, there was the time you wrote the song from the Psalm of Nephi.
Oh, yeah, right.
And I thought that you were struggling like most of us were with, you know, masturbation and pornography,
right, which
those
is
kinds
like,
of things.
Was always, like, symbolic of being gay, right? Because if I would masturbate, it was usually with some sort of gay fantasy, right?
But and I so, had no idea. There was no way for me to know that. Why didn't you ever tell me?
Because I don't know why. Because it was such a deep, dark, horrible, horrible secret, you know? Because when you're gay, it feels like that's who you are. It's anchored into your whole being, right?
Yeah.
And that was Satan. So I felt like there's this horrible demon inside me, and that part was, I didn't want to share that with most people. And the only reason I shared it was because I wanted help.
So I wanted to talk a little bit more about the song that you wrote.
Go ahead.
The Psalm of Nephi, which is really a great song, I thought. And you quoted from 2 Nephi chapter 4, and I wanted to read a few of those verses because, that's how you felt at the time.
Right.
It says, O wretched man that I am, yea, my heart sorroweth because of my flesh. My soul grieveth because of mine iniquities. I am encompassed about because of the temptations and the sins which so easily beset me. And when I desire to rejoice, my heart groaneth because of my sins. Nevertheless, I know in whom I have trusted. And then your chorus was, Awake, my soul, no longer droop in sin. Rejoice, O my heart, and give place no more for the enemy of my soul. So you were like so much fighting with yourself to...
Yeah, it was... And, you know, I had never done anything with any guy. It was just that I knew that I wanted to, and I didn't want to. And so it was all purely an internal struggle. And that's why I finally broke down and told President. So I wrote him this letter that said, you know, just what I just said, that I've never done anything, but I have these temptations. I don't want the temptations anymore. I want them to go away.
So what was his counsel? What did he suggest?
He said that he was really impressed with me, that I even cared, and that most people who were 16 didn't even care about the church, or not to the degree that I did.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know that I would have been so religious without it, because it forced me to confront my beliefs, and, you know, everything that I had been taught my whole life was about family and celestial marriage and the purity of marriage and all of that. And that's really what I wanted.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, I was literally afraid that I would not be able to get an erection if I got married to a woman.
Mm-hmm.
So it was both the attraction to men, but also the lack of physical attraction to women that terrified me.
Right.
So
it's more...
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, so when you were with women, it was more like...
I was trying, you know. I was hoping. I was somehow fantasizing this, like I said, through the eyes of other guys in this weird way.
Okay, yeah.
You know?
I can see that. So you were planning on getting married even though you knew you were gay. I mean, as a member of the church, is that what...
I wanted to, but I was really scared to.
Mm-hmm. So,
and I wouldn't have if I hadn't, unless I had really felt like I wasn't having this issue anymore.
Uh-huh. So how did you finally get to the point where you were ready to serve a mission and you felt like you could do that?
When I got to BYU, I also told my... Oh, and I had told my parents, too.
How did they respond?
Like, I wrote my mom a letter basically with the same thing, saying, I don't know what to do. I need help. I need to go to a psychiatrist or something, basically, was what I was saying.
Uh-huh.
And my mom was just like, you're not gay.
Really?
And she cried and cried. She's like, but I was like, but I'm trying to change. I don't want to, I'm going to change. I've never done anything. I'm just telling you because I don't know what to do. And my dad, you know, my dad came down later because my mom talked to my dad about it. And he was like, you know, when I was your age, there were some times I thought I might be gay. And then I grew out of it.
Huh.
So that was kind of sweet, I thought, that my dad would, like, try to relate and be nice about it.
Yeah.
So then at BYU, I told my bishop when I got there, and they have, like, counseling to help you change your sexuality at BYU.
They had it all set up and ready to go.
Yeah, and they, you know, I missed the, like, the church used to give people electroshock therapy or shock therapy or something. And I missed that by like 10 years.
I'm glad you missed that.
Thank God I missed that. But it was like, yeah, I met a friend. A friend came out to us actually one time. And he said, I just want to tell you guys something about myself so you understand who I am. I used to be gay, but I've changed my sexuality. And of course, he's out of the closet now. but at the time, I was like, okay, well, I want to see who you're seeing because I want to change my sexuality. So I went through this, like, therapy for it, and it was really pretty ridiculous. I mean, basically, they were like, well, you need to play more sports so that you can have, like, physical contact with men in the right way.
Oh, so they thought because you didn't play sports, you were missing out on that kind of camaraderie, like manly man touching and stuff like that.
Right, and that's why I was desiring it. And it all seemed to boil down to whether we masturbated or not. So if I was able to not masturbate, it seemed to mean that I was changing my sexuality because I wasn't giving in to that physical thing, which now seems a little ridiculous. But
so that was the evidence.
That was the evidence that I was changing, right.
And so how long did you have to go without masturbating before you could serve a mission?
I think that once I had hit like 6 months or something.
6 months? Holy cow.
I think that's when I finally felt like I was ready to go on a mission.
Oh my gosh.
And I just
talk about taking a loaded gun to the mission
field. No kidding.
Oh my gosh.
I thought, oh, well, I've changed. I feel straight. And I thought a mission would just seal the deal. Mm-hmm. You know, if I worked really hard, then at the end of it, God would really bless me. And everything would be gone and I would be changed and everything would be better.
Right. So you got your call.
Which I was super excited about because I went to New Zealand and everybody who had been there on their mission just said it was so beautiful and amazing. And I was really excited to get to go to someplace like exotic and beautiful.
Mm-hmm. And I don't remember. Did you finish 2 years at BYU before you went on your mission?
I did a year and a whole summer.
Okay. So I was a senior when you just were leaving for your mission. I was just going into my senior year of high school.
Were we still in contact then?
Yes.
Okay, because I was away, but were we, like, did we write letters, or how
yeah,
were we in?
Yeah, we wrote letters, and we talked on the phone. In fact, one time, when we were talking on the phone, it was the end of my junior year of high school, and I told you that I loved you, and you said that you couldn't love me in that way. And I mean, I knew that already somehow, but I remember that conversation.
But I did love you, Zelpha. I loved you to death. We had so much fun together. I remember, do you remember when, like, we were 16, or you, I think you just turned 16 and you took me on your first date.
Uh-huh.
Do you remember that?
Yeah.
And we went out on a boat in Lake Superior and then saw the sunset and it was so beautiful. And it's one of my favorite memories of Michigan, actually.
Oh.
But yeah, I didn't have the romantic love for you, but that was not your fault, obviously.
Right. Well, I wondered. I mean, it was hard for me to understand how we could get along so well. And you not have more of an interest that way in me, but you know, I thought just I just somehow wasn't attractive to you anyway. And that was true, but I wasn't thinking about it the right way.
Right. So, yeah, so I went on my mission, and it was really, really hard at first because I guess you never went on a mission, right? But, you know,
right.
Everyone knows a mission is a struggle. It's really hard to find people to teach, and it tests your testimony. I mean, it really... you really confronted with a lot of things. And then it just quickly started to fall apart. But it was just like I was in Michigan. Like, outwardly, I was doing great. And I baptized people. And, you know, my mission president called me a baptizing missionary. And my companions liked working with me. And they were always like, man, you work so hard. And you're so... you try so hard to be Christ-like, and, you know.
Well, you were trying so hard.
And so, but inwardly, I was still having these awful struggles, and it was devastating, because I thought that if I went on my mission and I worked hard, I wouldn't be confronted with these feelings, that they would be quickly evaporating, and they only got worse. And on top of that, there was other doctrinal issues that I was confronted with that were really hard for me to deal with. And the main one was the race issue. And I don't know if you remember, but it bothered me even in high school. And I was always just trying to find a way to accept the fact that, you know, blacks couldn't have the priesthood until 1978. And it was hard for me to understand how my parents could have joined the church with that doctrine in place. It was just incomprehensible because my parents are not racist.
Uh-huh. You know?
They never, ever said anything racist. They have never said it my whole life, you know?
Uh-huh. So how could they just accept that?
Right. But it became worse on my mission because, you know, the Polynesians are considered Lamanites.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, like, we'd be teaching some Maori person or whatever, and they'd be, like, all into it and really enjoying it. And then we'd come back, and they'd look me straight in the eyes, and they'd be like, why do I have dark skin? And I'd be like, oh, shit, they talked to somebody. Well, I guess I wouldn't have said, oh, shit, but I'd be like, oh, man, they heard. They found out this horrible doctrine about getting cursed with black skin. And I read the Book of Mormon probably 10 or 15 times while I was on my mission. And the more you read it, the more you realize it's all about how the Native Americans were cursed because they were wicked. So God gave the land to the Europeans and allowed them to, you know, allowed the genocide because they deserved it, because mm-hmm. they had rejected Christ. It became hard to deal with. And like, there was this other time when I had this Maori companion, and we were like reading church pamphlets. And do you know the Three Degrees of Glory, that pamphlet? It's like really old. It's like Melvin J. Ballard or something like that.
I've probably seen it, but go ahead.
And that pamphlet really lays out the whole thing about how, you know, the spirits were not valiant. This is where I think this doctrine is really clearly stated, that those who were not valiant in the pre-existence were the ones that were born into dark skin. And, you know, here's my Maori companion, and there's this sentence in there that says something like, you know, why, you know, obviously people were more valiant because some people were born to the Hottentots in the South Seas or something like that. And others are born to beautiful, white, Latter-day Saint mothers.
Mm-hmm.
And my companion was reading that out loud to me. And I was just like, doesn't that bother you? And he was like, no. And then he like laid down on his bed, and like 10 minutes later, he's like, you know what? That really does bother me.
Huh.
And, but I couldn't, what I felt like was happening was that Satan was the one that was causing me to doubt. Like, this was like a test of my faith. And the only reason that I was having trouble dealing with it was because I wanted to be gay. And I was just looking for some excuse. You know, that's how I felt, is that Satan was just giving me some excuse to doubt the church. But the real reason was because I wanted to leave a church so I could be gay.
You're doing mental gymnastics.
Right. Right. So and then there was this other time when we did trade-offs with the APs, and I got back, and we all got in a circle to pray, the four, you know, my companion and the two APs. And my companion says, and one of the APs is Polynesian, and my companion says in his prayer, please help us to find more white people to teach.
Whoa. Why?
And like the APs left, and I was like, what? I've never heard you talk. Did you say that in your prayer? Like, what is going on? And he's like, yeah, Elder T, we called him that because we couldn't pronounce his last name or whatever. So the Polynesian one, Elder T, he's like, yeah, Elder T told me that President Grant told him that there was direction from the area presidency that we should try to find more white people because there's a need for more good, strong priesthood holders in the South, you know, in Oceania.
More leadership.
Yeah. And if you look around, all the strongest ones are white, so we should try to find more white priesthood holders.
Yeah.
And that was just awful. And
yeah, you never told me about any of these kind of issues. I don't remember you mentioning it much in high school, but you probably did. It was one of those things that I just never allowed myself to think about very much.
Right. But what's really sad is that because I wanted to change so bad, I submitted to that direction. And I even prayed myself that we could find more white people to teach. And that was really a low point in my mission because at that point, something that I believed so strongly, because, you know, trying to be Christ-like, right? Love all people. Who cares what color their skin is? Who cares where they're coming from, what their past is?
Mm-hmm.
And I denied that true belief of mine just with the hopes that it would help me change my sexuality.
Because you were being obedient.
Because I was being obedient.
So, do you want to talk about the end of your mission?
Yeah, so, you know, at the same time I'm starting to doubt the church, you know, I'm also having these, like, sexual fantasies and these horrible things. And I told my mission president, I was always telling all my priesthood leaders because I was just honest. I was just being honest about what I was going through.
And you were supposed to, and they were supposed to help you somehow. By telling them, they would, you know, give you this prescription, and you could find
right. Read the Book of Mormon every day. You know,
yeah. Well, how many years do you have to do that before you finally say that's not working?
Right, but you know, they were always nice to me because they could see that I was sincerely trying to change. So what can they say? They can't think I'm a horrible person, right?
Yeah, and besides that, you had never done anything.
I had never done anything, and you know, I did tell, you know, I did finally masturbate on my mission, and that was also very devastating. But
how could you not? I mean, I can't even imagine.
It had been like over a year. it was just, yeah. Finally, I just, you know, it just had to happen.
Yeah.
And then, you know, so I told my mission president that, and he looked amused. You know, because it was like he knew every person, every boy or person deals with that, right? Uh-huh, uh-huh. So he was like, he's nice about it, but he had like really lame advice. Like he would say like, okay, what's a food that you really hate that makes you nauseous? And so like mussels or something. And he'd be like, well, you need to go to the grocery store and get a big bucket of mussels. And every time you have a thought about a man, just like eat mussels and make yourself sick.
Oh.
And that way, eventually, you won't want to think about it because it'll make you sick.
Like aversion therapy. Isn't that what it's?
Exactly.
So did you try eating a bucket of mussels?
No, I just couldn't bring myself to do that. But he also made me stop playing the piano.
He thought that made you gay?
He thought that if I was willing to show the Lord that I could sacrifice the one thing that was the most important to me, that would help show the Lord that I was really trying to change. And then he told me he was going to make me AP before I left my mission. But that didn't happen. So then one of my companions, like, we almost had sex. And I didn't even like him. I was just like, what? So sexually charged. And he kind of like came over into my bed and was like laying next to me. And like, we were giving each other massages.
Uh-huh.
And then I was just like, oh my God, no, I can't do this. And I like get up. And I write President Grant a letter, and I'm like, I'm about to have sex with my companion.
Was your companion gay, too?
I don't know. Like, he was Western Samoan, and he didn't speak English that well. So we were mostly communicating through body language anyway, right? So it's hard for me to know whether he was gay or he was just
very lovey-dovey.
Well, there was sexual tension, but maybe it's just because he was all, you know, because we couldn't do anything with women and we were just all of us were going crazy.
Uh-huh.
So the president got my letter, and within like 2 hours, I was shifted out of there. And then he put me with like one of the APs. So I was like assistant to the AP or whatever. And that was Elder and I was even worse than having any sort of sexual attraction, I was in love with him. He was the nicest guy. He built me up. He didn't know what happened. Nobody knew why this emergency sudden shift happened, right? And I had people lined up to baptize, and I was gone. I didn't even get to say goodbye to them. But he was just like, President Grant says you're going to be famous someday. Like, I hear you're amazing at the piano. I hear you're an amazing missionary. And just like, always being so nice, and because he was AP, we got to drive around. And this was actually the only time I was outside of Auckland on my mission. And we would like drive up to the North Islands and drive across this beautiful land together, listen to music in the car. We like on this constant road trip, and I just fell head over heels for him. And he was handsome, and and that was more devastating than almost having sex, because that's when I really knew that I was never going to change. Is when it was the love for him that helped me know that I was never going to change. It was horrible. So eventually, just one night, my brain turned off. I was in the middle of, you know, I actually wasn't with Elvis anymore. I was with the next companion. And I just, like, in the middle of the night, at this point, I had also asked President Grant if I could go home because I was done. I was like, I need to go home. And he's like, Elder, the last thing you want to do is go home. And he wouldn't let me go home.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, basically, you know, I wasn't thinking at the time, but as I look back on it, I was going to do whatever it took to get home. And I was going to do something to get sent home.
Mm-hmm.
So I woke up in the middle of the night and I looked up escort in the Yellow Pages and found the male escort and went and met him at a motel, rode my bike, snuck out, and I don't remember the sex. It was over in like 2 minutes. And then he held me and we laid in bed together for, you know, like an hour. And he was just really sweet. And I, to be in the arms of somebody strong with, you know, feel protected like that, being able to just like run my hands along his jawline or, you know, just snuggle up close to him. It was, you know, I'll never forget it. It was so beautiful. And then at one point he's like, so, you know, asking me about myself, and I'm like, I'm a Mormon missionary. And he's like, how did you get here? And I'm like, my bike's outside. And he thought this was all very amusing. Mm-hmm. And then he's like, well, what are you going to do now? And I'm like, well, I'm sure I'll be going back to America. He's like, you don't have to tell anyone. And I'm like, there's no way I could be on my mission. Yeah, I could be teaching after this. You know, I would feel like too much of a hypocrite.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, he's like, well, they have a good gay scene in America. And I was like, oh, I just don't know what I'm going to do. I don't know what I'm going to do. And he put his hand on my heart and he said, you need to listen to your heart. And that was the most amazing thing I had heard in a long time, because here I am on my mission telling everybody the way that you know that what's true is by the feelings in your heart. And it was all about going deep into your heart and listening to your deepest, still small voice. And here I was with a man in bed and my heart felt like it was burning because it felt so beautiful to be with this guy.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm really happy that that happened. And it was one of the best things that ever happened to me. So, but then, okay, so I get back on my bike. I'm riding back to my apartment. It's 3 a.m. I'm sure my companion's going to be awake. I have no idea what's going to happen now. So I get home. He's still asleep. I call President Grant at 3 a.m. And I'm like, President Grant, I'm going back to America. And he says, why? What did you do? And I said, I just had sex with a male prostitute and paid for it with my missionary support fund.
And he said, yep, you're right. You're going back.
He goes, he still didn't want to send me home. He still wanted me to stay because he knew that if I went home, I was going to leave the church.
Mm-hmm.
And he did not want me to leave the church. And he knew how hard I was trying. And he wrote this letter to my parents and another one to my state president saying, like, Nate was a great missionary. Don't think of this as a disgrace. He just had some struggles. He's going back with some struggles. But don't think of this as a disgrace because he was a good missionary while he was here.
That was nice of him.
Yeah, it was super nice. But he's like, well, let me call Salt Lake and I'll call you back. And I was home. You know, they had my flight in 2 days and we had a Zone conference. And he's like, I really think you need to, he's like, don't tell him what happened, but you need to say something. You can't leave without saying something to the missionaries because they're going to be so confused.
Uh-huh.
So basically, like, you know, at Zone Conference, at the end, every single missionary goes, you know, you go down the rows and everybody bears their testimony. So I'm like near, I was set way in the back, and then President Grant says, you know, we're going to start from the back. So I stood up and I just said, like, I know the church is true, but, you know, no matter how good you think you are and no matter how much you follow the rules, just beware because Satan can get you. And I cried, and then everybody else who bore their testimony after me, well, not like my good friends, they were just like, we love you, Elder Coe, and you were a great missionary, and I don't know what happened, but I'll always love you, you know, kind of thing. Uh-huh. And then I got home, and I met my parents in the airport, and they were like, what did you do? I think they said, like, we love you, what did you do? And I was like, I had sex. And they were just like, you know, their faces were just blank. And they just couldn't say anything. And they had this, like, really worried, well, just this really, like, they were back in their heads and they just didn't know what to think. And so they drove me straight to the church, straight to talk to the stake president. And he's like, take off your tags, you're released. And I didn't know this guy because my parents had moved to Colorado Springs after I went to college. So I had never met this guy. So he didn't know me. And all he knew about me was that I had sex with a prostitute on my mission. Uh-huh. He just thought I was the most horrible, you know, disgusting person. And he just treated me like that. He didn't want to know anything about me. He was just like, we have to have a church court. And, so he's like, so I don't know if you know, but when you have a church court, you get served a summons. And so, like, I go to church my first Sunday back, and it's already really hard to deal with because everybody knows I'm home early. You know, it's like, mm-hmm. I'd been gone a year. And even though I hadn't met them before, they knew from my parents, you know, or whatever, that they had a son on the mission and he came home early. And so that's really hard to just look anyone in the face, you know.
So you were gone on your mission for a year?
Yeah, about a year.
When
maybe even only 9 months or something like that.
I thought it was a little longer.
See, I started in September and it seems like it was summer when I came back.
Okay, so I was already at BYU because I started in the summer. That's when it was.
So then we have the church court, and, you know, again, it's people that don't know me. And so you're supposed to, like, there's people supposed to speak for, I don't know, they draw lots or whatever, and, like, half of them are supposed to, like, speak on your defense, and half of them are supposed to speak on the church's defense.
Really?
And so I sit there, yeah, something like that. And so I sit there, and I have to sit there while President like tells him everything I did. And he had asked me, like, who did what to who, you know, all the details.
Oh, all the details, right.
Because it makes a difference whether, you know, I gave oral sex or he gave oral sex or whatever. I don't know.
Right.
So he sits there and describes the whole sexual act to 12 people while I'm sitting there, right?
Yeah.
And then I don't know if anyone was speaking for me because it didn't sound like they were. Anyone was. Uh-huh. You know? But they're, you know, the question is, don't you want to have a family? And I'm like, you have no idea how badly I want to have a family. You know, just these asinine questions that obviously they had no idea what I had been trying to do. And it was just really, really disappointing because I knew in my heart that God knew that I was trying my best. And I knew that these guys did not know that. And they were supposed to be inspired.
Right.
They were the leaders who were supposed to know God's will.
And they were going to judge you.
Yeah, and they judged me. So they weren't too mean. And I guess, you know, my bishop, I guess he could have been nice because they read the letter from my mission president in the church court. So at least I had that. And I told him I was still trying to change, because at that point I was still thinking I would still try to change. And so they disfellowshipped me. They didn't excommunicate me, and they put me back in therapy to change my sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
And they told me I couldn't play piano for church.
What?
Because I was disfellowshipped. Oh. So that I'd have to sit there, like, you know, priesthood opening exercises, and they'd be like, does anyone play the piano? We need somebody to play the piano so we can
sing
a hymn.
Please, anybody. And then somebody's plunking out that dong, dong, dong.
And, I had to sit there. It was, you know, that's how I worshiped God, was through my music. And that they took away my ability to worship God in the way that helped me and sustained me.
So how long did you stay disfellowshipped for?
So I got, you know, I couldn't go back to BYU. So basically I spent a semester in Colorado Springs practicing. And then for the winter semester, I auditioned for the music school at CU Boulder, and I got in. And so I started school at CU Boulder. And when I made that transition from Colorado Springs to Boulder, I decided, because, you know, if I had tried that hard for that many years and I was only like 80% gay, but I had clearly come 20% of the way, I would have said, okay, well, I can keep going another, you know, 20 years and then I'll be 100% straight, uh-huh, or whatever.
Right.
But I was still 100% gay.
You know? Right. All the effort had nothing to show for it.
Right, exactly.
As far as that went.
And I just stopped connecting the church knowing what God knew about me. And I realized the church did not know what was in my heart, and they were judging me. You know, and somebody who's faithful to the church could see my saying that as some sort of justification or some sort of rationalization. But that's what I knew in my heart. I knew that I would always be gay, and that I was gay. And you can't know that and believe the church is true at the same time. That's just not an option. Mm-hmm. You don't have that option.
Right. I was going to say that when I found out that you had got sent home from your mission, I think you sent me an email, but you didn't say why. And you didn't tell me why for several months. And I was curious, but, you know, and I wanted to know, but I didn't want to know. And then when you finally told me, actually, you didn't tell me what you were sent home for many years, but you finally told me that you were gay. It wasn't until January after you got home from your mission.
Yeah, because that's when I came out. So I finally came out on it in January. So that makes sense.
Yeah, and that hit me like, I mean,
how did I tell you?
In an email.
What did I say?
Well, let's see. I did find my journal entry from that day.
Oh, really?
Or from that week? Yeah, it was like right after my birthday. And it said, let's see. Tuesday, I got an email from Nathan in which he proclaimed that he was gay, and that's the way he was created, and God loves him for who he is. I wrote back and told him I love him and that I'll always pray for him. I ached inside all week. My love for Nathan is so strong that it literally sickens my body when I learn of his sins and problems. And then I received a priesthood blessing on Thursday night, and since then I've had peace.
Who gave you your bishop at BYU? Or?
Probably my elders quorum president there, I would think. So I mean, I just felt sick, I guess.
Yeah. And I kind of remember, like, being at BYU, because I think I, like, took a pilgrimage back to BYU after that.
You surprised me. Yeah.
And then I just remember, like, trying to talk to you about it, and you were trying to understand, you know?
Well, like, I mean, I loved you so much, I couldn't think of you badly, and yet I knew that, you know, from my perspective as a believing Mormon, that it was a sin and that you could change, because that's what I had been taught. So I couldn't, I mean, you know, sometimes I had fantasies that maybe if you just, like, would have sex with a woman, then maybe you could see that, well, that's not so bad. Maybe I could, you know, be straight. So I had fantasies.
That's what my mom said, too.
Really? Yeah, I had fantasies like I'd show you my boobs and then and tell you that you know, you could have sex with me. And all of this, of course, for, you know, for your eternal salvation. But that's what I never told you.
That's hilarious. Well, that's very sweet of you.
Yeah, I sacrificed myself.
That's kind of touching.
But, so you came out, and you still, I mean, you always were happy on the outside, and you seemed happy, and you seemed at peace with your decision.
I was elated to come out of the closet. Like, it felt so good to finally not hate myself. It was a miracle. I was truly happy for the first time in many, many, many years. It wasn't just a surface happy, but down in my core, I was happy.
Through and through. And you went and started going to Christian churches right away, right? Because you still had a lot of faith.
I didn't want to give up the idea of Jesus. I knew I couldn't be a Mormon anymore, but I couldn't let go of Jesus. And so, yeah, I started going to Christian churches.
Did you know you were my last kiss before before I married John?
No. It wasn't
much of a kiss.
I'm sure.
No, it was at BYU when you came that one time, and it was just when I had just started dating John.
Uh-huh.
And we always kind of held hands, you and I, and you would do that with a lot of your friends, and so we were holding hands, and a mutual acquaintance of John and I saw us holding hands, and he warned John off of me because you know, I was like gallivanting around with other men kind of thing. But then when you were getting ready to leave, I said, yeah, I always wanted to kiss you. And you said, okay. So I just gave you a little peck.
That's nice.
Oh, yeah, and I also asked you your opinion about John. And you said, he's not my type.
Sorry, John.
But he seems like a nice guy, he said.
Funny.
So the years kind of went on. How long did you keep going to the Christian churches for?
Maybe about a year. And then eventually I let go of all my religious beliefs, because I don't know if you still believe in God, but it's hard to believe in God anymore after you leave the Mormon church.
Yeah.
Because if something's wrong that they said, it puts everything into question. And you've done so many, you've exerted so much mental effort to force yourself to believe that you really don't have the energy to do that again. Was
right.
that what you experienced?
Well, yeah, sort of. I mean, for a while, even still, the thought of like really believing something, I mean, if the Mormon church isn't true, then I kind of saw it as like the only hope for a true religion. I don't know. I mean, I'm actually kind of feeling sad about this whole thing yesterday and today. I just wish that I could believe. I miss it in a lot of ways, but there's just, I just can't make myself believe, no matter.
Yeah, once you Once you've tried so hard to believe in something and it turned out not to be true, it's just, you can't, it's so hard to believe in anything.
Yeah, I remember one time you called, or I called, one of our phone conversations, and you were telling me about a book that you had found, you were reading about evolution.
Mm-hmm.
And you were like, I never really understood all this stuff, but now it all makes sense. And what do you think about evolution? Like, you were trying to work it out in your mind about what you thought about it, and that was quite a few years after you'd stopped going to church at all. Did it take you a while to kind of work to the point where you really didn't believe in God anymore?
Yeah, it was a several-year journey. And, you know, one by one, just like the beliefs, the word of wisdom was the last thing to go.
Really? You held on to that the longest?
Yeah, because although that reminds me of that story you told about buying that coffee in the grocery store.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it is a very kind of obvious breaking of everything you've ever been taught. And something that you've been taught was dangerous.
And you know, I kind of wish I had never broken the word of wisdom in a way, because, like, really, it's not better than the high that you can get off of life, you know?
Well, that's true.
And
alcohol is very disappointing to me. For one thing, it doesn't taste good. I especially wanted to like wine so I could be, you know, sophisticated and talk about the nuances of the different flavors in wine, but it just doesn't taste good to me. Does it taste good to you?
Yeah, I mean, I'm probably, you know, I drink alcohol, I drink whatever. I mean, I have, you know, that's what normal people do in life, so.
Right.
But yeah, no, I guess it doesn't taste good. It's just nice. It just, you know, relaxes you and makes mm-hmm. you know, social lubricant and whatever. But
well, it definitely has a purpose. I just thought the way people talked about it, that it would taste good.
You thought it would taste like heaven.
Yeah.
And coffee, I thought coffee would taste good too because it smelled so good.
Oh, I know. And it does taste good when it's mixed with a lot of sugar and milk.
Sugar and cream, yeah, exactly.
When it turns into a dessert, then I like it.
Yeah. But I don't know how I could have ever been in college without coffee, because it's essential now for me in the morning. But
it makes me jittery, so I can't even... I have to drink decaf if I drink it, and, you know, that's not as fun. It's not as tasty.
No.
Let's see. There were a few more things...
So let me tell you how I was finally excommunicated.
Oh, yeah. I forgot you were excommunicated.
Yeah, so my parents kept giving the church my address whenever I changed apartments in Boulder or whatever. And so, like, home teachers would come over. And I would, like, stand there at the door and I'd be like, look, I'm gay. I'm out of the closet. I don't believe in the church. And yet they would still come back because my parents would call them and say, have you been over to visit Nathan? Whatever.
Uh-huh.
So finally the only way I could get them to stop was I wanted to take my name off the records of the church. And so I wrote a letter to the church saying, you know, God loves me the way I am. And they sent me a letter back saying you need to talk to your local priesthood leader for this. And then, so I sent the letter to President, you know, saying, I want my name removed off the records of the church. And he said I wasn't worthy to take my name off the records of the church because I was disfellowshipped.
What?
I know, it doesn't make any sense, does it? He's like, we have to... What?
I don't think that's true. I mean, I don't, legally, I don't think they have any grounds there.
Yeah, I don't think so either, but he was like, we have to have another church court. And I was like, I was like, if I don't show up, do I automatically get excommunicated? He was like, probably. I was like, okay, well, you have your church court. Have fun. Do what you need to do. And he wrote me a letter eventually saying, you know, you're excommunicated, not for being gay. That's not what they said, but because I was teaching false doctrine by saying that God loved me the way I was. And that was heresy.
Oh, my.
So now I like to tell people, like, I'm officially a heretic. Isn't that cool?
Wow, that's
amazing. I'm actually kind of proud of that.
I think that they were, I mean, totally out of line not letting you resign when you asked to. I mean, it's a voluntary organization.
Yeah, he probably made that up, or he thought that for some reason. But
yeah, I think what they
did. Glad. I'm actually glad that happened because I like being excommunicated because people think that's cool.
Like, yeah,
it just sounds so harsh, you know, excommunicated.
Well, it is harsh. But by that time, you, like you said, you were already ready to take your name off. So not a big blow.
No, it was exciting. So let's go back, because you said to me in an email that eventually you did come to terms with my being gay, and so let's talk about that.
Well, it took years of internal struggle and turmoil. I mean, it might seem strange to you that it was such a big deal to me, but, I mean, I thought about it every day for years and tried to figure out either some way that I could magically, like, help you change, or I just couldn't figure it out. And I remember one time I was working at a hospital, and we had pop machines to give pop to the patients. Not like they need pop, but there was a sign on one of the spouts, and it said out of order. And I remember thinking, wow, that's what I thought about you being gay, that it was just out of order, that, you know, it just kind of messes up the whole order of everything. There's supposed to be a man and a woman. They get sealed together. They have children, and they, you know, that's how the plan of salvation is based on a man and woman. And it was just so hard for me to understand and to come to terms with.
Because it doesn't make any sense. It really doesn't.
No. But I think finally when you told me about how the sex that you had, especially on your mission, that wasn't the important part. The important thing that meant a lot to you was cuddling with a man and being held by a man and also being in love with a man. Like for a long time, I kind of justified, your being gay as, well, you know, anybody could be gay because sex feels good to everybody. You can have sex with anybody or basically anything and it would feel good. And I also explored my own, like, you know, am I bisexual? Because could I be gay? And when I finally came to the conclusion that no, I could not be gay, I could not be in love with a woman. I would not want to cuddle a woman and be held by a woman and stuff like that. That's when I finally got it. When I finally understood what being gay meant and how you felt.
So, did you at that point accept it?
Yeah, well, by the time, I mean, I couldn't get to that point until after I had already had my own doubts with the church. Because before that, it wasn't even an option to say, that's okay. Being gay is okay. You know, because when I was a believer.
You can't. No. Think that's okay if you believe in the Mormon Church. That's just not possible.
No, so it wasn't until after I left that I was finally able to understand and accept and say, yeah, Nathan's gay and that's just the way he is and there's nothing wrong with it even. Like, why should he have to change it? And I hope that he finds someone, you know, to love and...
Which I never did.
You're still young.
Yeah, I had like 3 boyfriends in my life, and I just couldn't... I'm such an independent person that I couldn't... I ended up feeling trapped. And I think after it has something to do with being Mormonism and leaving, where I just couldn't commit to something forever. I just couldn't believe in something forever. And so all 3 of them, like after a year and a half, I just left because I wasn't ready for forever.
Mm-hmm.
And now I haven't dated anyone in many years.
Really?
Like 7, 8 or something. And it's like a little part of myself is dead. It's really sad. And, but I moved back to Colorado in November, and I really feel like this is my home, and I bought a house, and I'm feeling more domestic now. And I'm really hoping that I will find someone that I just naturally love. I don't have to try hard. I don't have to force myself. It's just something that happens. And I get to cuddle. I could live without sex for the rest of my life. I don't care. But I just wish I had someone still to cuddle with.
I'm with you on that one. I mean, sex is great and all, but that's not the most important thing of a relationship.
Right. So I have lots of gay friends who are in relationships, and they seem to be happy. It's just that I haven't been able to find that yet. But I said, I feel like I'm coming back to myself by coming back to Colorado.
And, I mean, you are young, only 35, and there's a lot of many heterosexual people who find love after, you know, I don't know what I'm trying to say.
You're saying there's nothing wrong with me.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with you, and it'll come if you want it to. But,
and I do. And I want to have a kid. I really do. Like, I'm around my nieces and nephews all the time now since I came back, and they are so cute. I love watching them learn something. Like, you can see when they make a connection for the first time. Something that seems so simple, like, oh, I can pass something from one hand to the other or whatever, you know. And it's just so amazing to see a child grow up, and I would like to have that experience, but I could never do that on my own. I need to have a partner if I was ever going to attempt that in some way through adoption or surrogate mother or who knows, something like that.
Well, I've always thought that you would be a great dad, so I hope that happens for you sometime. Well, thank you so much, Nate, for sharing your story and having this conversation with me today.
It was really good to talk to you.
You too. And for our listeners, the discussion continues on the website at MormonExpression.com.